Okay. Lars asked me to talk about excavation or accretion from classical novae, and of course, part of the reason is to try and understand whether classical novae have any kind of relation to type 1a supernovae, which is one of the more important subjects of this meeting. There are all kinds of changes. That's why I had to skip yesterday. I apologize to the people who talked. So let me start off with reminding you that there are some fellow travelers in this talk. Peter Hauschult, Rafe Hicks, Jan-Uwe Ness, who's done the X-ray stuff, Frank Timmies, Christian Iliadis, as you'll see later on where they come in on this. And this is a review that you don't need to see, just to remind you that we're all on the same page trying to understand why there's type 1a supernovae. They have very similar light curves, and they seem to indicate the particular model that we're talking about. One of the things that I do want to emphasize, and I'll be emphasizing through most of the talk, is that there's no sign of hydrogen or helium in the spectrum at any time during the evolution. However, if you look at the spectra, these are taken from Alex's review, you see very high velocity silicon and calcium and magnesium early in the spectral evolution. And, whoops, is it already there, or is it present in the outer layers? Another observational paper from Craig Wheeler and colleagues is that if you look at the spectra of type 1a supernovae, oxygen is much more abundant than carbon by factors of 100 to 1,000, and I'll come back to this later. So here's the model that we've all been talking about, and from what I can gather, if you guys have been talking about it for weeks, and we're just getting here now, so you'll have to put up with me. White dwarf component, close binary stellar system, what class? How do we get rid of the hydrogen and helium? So here's the model that everybody's sort of settling on. Thermonuclear runaway, 1.4 solar mass, carbon oxygen, white dwarf. Need accretion from a binary companion, you know, motherhood, apple pie. But unless the secondary has a strange composition, it's transferring hydrogen and helium. So we don't know what type of star explodes as a supernova 1a. I think that's even as of yesterday from what I heard. But there's no evidence for hydrogen or helium in the ejected gases. And for the observers know this, but the theoreticians should realize that this is extremely unusual. And so people have tried all different ways to find the 1As. Other people can't bear not knowing. So some of the suggestions are classical novae, but there's more masses ejected than accreted, and the abundances in nova ejecta that we've been doing for the last 10, 15 years show that there's a tremendous amount of core material in the ejecta, and it's probably whittling down the mass of the white dwarf. Dwarf novae, what we've just seen from Paula, the mass accretion rates are low. The masses are low. It's going to take forever. There's been a lot of suggestions about various types of recurrent novae. We suggested use SCO some 20 years ago. There's a lot of helium there that we've got to get rid of. And now everybody's focusing on RSOF. But there's so much hydrogen present in the system. If you look at the spectra of the current outburst taken a year ago, and try and hide the hydrogen, you know, we're only talking about ejection velocities, you know, maybe five times more than we observed in the system last year. I think it's very, very hard to hide the hydrogen. Okay, so I'm coming here not to bury super soft sources, but to praise them. And so you've all been hearing about this. Whoops, sorry. The proposal by Ed and collaborators in 1992, supersoft X-ray binary sources like Cal-83 and Cal-87, thermonuclear burning in the surface layers while they're accreting material, stable burning. Hydrogen burns to helium as fast as it accretes, but as you have already seen this morning and probably earlier, there's a broad variation, but I'll call it one. And you can argue with me later on. So about 3 × 10⁻⁷ solar masses for a 1.35 solar mass white dwarf. And we finally tested it with evolution codes, which is what I'm going to be talking about. So the stable burning white dwarf composition has hydrogen fusing to helium in the envelope. You have a carbon-oxygen core. You build up this layer of helium. And then the mass of the white dwarf reaches 1.35 solar masses, and it blows up. And here are some examples of a super soft source. I think Ed showed this some weeks ago. This is from the annual reviews article by Peter Kahabka and Ed. Cal 83, you notice that the energy is coming around half a kilovolt or less. And of course, the reason is very simple. You have a black body here of 300,000 degrees. You have a detector with a very narrow range. You have the interstellar medium cutting you off. And so this is the only region where you expect to get any kind of emission in the X-rays. However, if you go to grating spectra, which is now becoming important with Chandra and XMM, you can get a very broad wavelength coverage. This is Cal 83, Thierry Lanz et al. We're working on SMC3 now. And if you analyze the grating spectra, you can get effective temperatures that are really quite accurate and much better than, say, fitting black body models to the PSPC energy distribution. And you get a pretty good white dwarf mass close to the Chandrasekhar limit. We've been doing that ourselves. We've started off with Novi, but we get, again, 600,000 degrees. And we get massive white dwarfs. The black line here is the model fit. The red is, of course, the observations. This is done with Chandra and was Alexander Petz's PhD dissertation. Okay, so if you take the observations, these are boxes. The observers can't do any better with the low-resolution ROSAT. But this is a green point here. That's Thierry Lanz's. And these are some of our models that I'll talk about later. But you see that some of them actually fit quite close to the models. Cal 87 is an eclipsing system, as you all know. And so it probably should fit up here if we could actually see the white dwarf. Okay, so let's segue to the theory and remind you that the calculations that I'm going to talk about are multi-zone Lagrangian full 1D hydro. The difference is that we have a large network from Frank Timmy's, or we're using larger and modern, well, Timmy's is certainly modern, but Hicks and Thielemann. Christian provides the reaction rate libraries, and one of the important things for NOVA studies, which I will talk about, is that we now include the PEP reaction, which was neglected in previous studies. It actually can increase. For low luminosity accretion, it can increase the energy production by about 40%. And there are other things we do too. Okay, so here are our initial models. We start with a classical NOVA simulation. We go through an outburst a few times, remove the ejected material. That means that the number of zones that we can include decreases as we get to the models I want to talk about. But we start with 150 zones and whittle them away down to about 100. We then allow the white dwarf to cool after the explosion until the luminosity is 30 suns. That's a measured luminosity for the white dwarf in Nova Sig 92, 3 years after outburst, which we got with STIS. Okay, we start accreting, assume no mixing with the core, so either solar or LMC metallicity. We include all necessary physics. I'm not in the physics department, so I don't have to say this anymore. Include all necessary stuff, and we evolve 1.25 and 1.35 solar mass white dwarfs and vary the mass accretion rates. And what we find in our models is that the hydrogen fuses to helium in the surface layers, and then helium fuses to carbon, oxygen, and more massive nuclei below the surface. And so we're not building up a helium layer, we're building up a layer of very high mass nuclei. In some cases, we get to an RP process. So here are the results. I apologize, you probably can't read it past the second row, but here's comparing solar and LMC metallicity. Just look here. This is 8.10 to the minus 7 solar masses, so above the canonical rate. Here is the canonical rate for stable burning, and you can see that we burn all the hydrogen and helium, and we get to quite large masses. Temperatures of 460, in some cases over 500 million degrees, densities of 10 to the 4th, that's an RP process, and we get to very high mass nuclei. And in the surface layers, so we don't need the shock to make some of the things that people might expect made in 1A supernovae. Okay, so surface zone masses, 10 to the minus 7 solar masses. The hydrogen fuses to helium by about 10 to the minus 6, so about 5-10 zones in. And then the helium burns, helium burns to carbon somewhat deeper, like about 10 to the minus 5 solar masses. We've accreted 3 times 10 to the 2. White dwarf has reached 1.38, blah, blah, blah. The point is that steady burning occurs in these models. We don't get thermonuclear runaways because this stuff is hot and it burns as it penetrates into the outermost layers. We have done this, as you could see on the previous transparency, for a variety of mass accretion rates. Here is the canonical plot that we've already seen for steady burning. At high mass, high luminosity, we get this steady, stable burning for a variety of mass accretion rates, which is good because no one has told me how the white dwarfs can read the literature. Now, here's 1.25 solar masses. Again, we get some very high mass. We get up to past oxygen 16. I just want to show you that at 1.25, we actually do get hydrogen thermal flashes, but they don't get violent enough to eject any material. Here's shows one of them. We're getting all kinds of things. So for a system like Cal-83, which has on and off states, it's possible that it has a lower mass, like 1.25, or maybe less. So there are lots and lots of things to study here. Okay. I do want to point out, here's the really important paper by Ken Nomoto back in 1982, where he accreted onto carbon-oxygen white dwarfs at rates that are below the canonical stable burning rate. If, in fact, we're right, then this is a valid study. Okay, let me remind you about what stable means for people talking about stable burning. You can have either the upper definitions or the lower definitions, where we can talk about stables and horses and cattle and stuff. And, of course, then there's stable burning. This statement from Tommy Gold, which you've all seen at various talks. Every complex, it's wrong. So here is what I've done in the last few weeks, is to go to low luminosity white dwarfs. The initial luminosity is down here. It's about 10 to the minus 2 suns. It's just so that I could get through this evolution quite rapidly. I've accreted at 2, 10 to the 10, minus 10, 2, 10 to the minus 9, to 2, 10 to the minus 7, 4, 10 to the minus 7, 8, 10 to the minus 7, and 2, 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year. I call this preliminary because I haven't run these all the way through a nova outburst, but they're certainly running away in a thermonuclear event. Here is 4, 10 to the minus 7 solar masses. We reach a peak luminosity of 4, 10 to the 4th suns, a peak effective temperature of 1,000,000, and we get mass ejected. And so let me then summarize. Hot white dwarfs can accrete at high mass accretion rates. Hydrogen fuses to helium in the surface layers. This is not canonical stable burning. The luminosity and effective temperature at 1.35 can remain virtually constant for years. At 1 1/4, we see that it goes through flashes. Range of mass accretion rates onto hot white dwarfs is much larger than the single value assumed for steady burning. We do not find stable burning at any. And so I will stop with that transparency.
And you actually stayed deeply inside the 20 minutes, so we have a long time for discussion.
I thought there would be.
Samra, it was very interesting. I have a comment and a question. The comment is there are many cases of transient and recurrent super soft X-ray sources, but we also have phenomena in which there is radiation on the secondary, and then it triggers different mass transfer, and you get a feedback on the nuclear burning rate. So you don't always have thermonuclear flashes, and it seems like that Cal 83 may be one of those, I'm sure. Rosanne agrees. It may not be the off state may not be due to the thermonuclear flash ending. So it may be a different phenomenon. There are some observational proofs. And then the question I had was...
I might disagree with you on that.
You disagree with...
Sure.
Okay, we'll talk about it. But maybe Rosanne should make her point. But the other, the question was about the SMC3. I got quite excited because I don't know how many people are familiar with this system, but it is a very hot symbiotic that seems to undergo steady burning, and it has been at practically constant temperature for about 15 years, it seems. So it's a very interesting system, and I wondered whether you had fuse data. What were you mentioning?
No, Chandra.
But there are no grating spectra, so...
Yes. They were taken last week or the last month.
But how could it's very? I mean, would be very, very low signal to noise.
I haven't seen the data yet. The PI on the proposal was Tier Lands.
Okay. Well, I would be curious.
I haven't seen the data.
It's very hard to get anything with a grating for this system. Anyway,
gratings are wonderful. You can actually do spectroscopy with gratings.
Ken would like to
watch. Where do you want to start, Ken?
Yes, since the result is the implication is so important, so I have to ask some kind of technical questions. Several things. You said you in simulating nova outburst, then you remove the zones in mass loss, and you decrease the mass zone number from 150 to 100. And my question is how you didn't rezone the outer ray of the white dwarfs during mass removing?
No.
So I think that's the reason why you get very thick zone in the outermost layer.
Now, the thick zones that you're referring to was in our initial study. I've done some more recent work where I've done much thinner zones. That was that transparency where I said that we get hydrogen down to depths of about 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. That's about 5-10 zones there. And then as it continues to accrete, we get the hydrogen's already gone. Then the helium fuses to carbon and oxygen. And as we get to deeper zones, the carbon and oxygen fuses higher. It depends, of course, on whether we've got all the proton captures in the network.
But still, I read your table, the temperature burning is 3 times 10 to the 8 degree, extremely high.
At the
and
surface,
that corresponds
yes.
to very thick zones. If you use 10 to the minus 7 solar mass in zones, you cannot get such high temperature in burning. And your number is just same as you published. No difference, as far as I noticed.
I had a problem here.
So my speculation is you have to rezone the outermost layers in nova explosions to continue. So each step you have to rezone, or you have to use Eulerian zone or whatever.
No, I don't think so.
Otherwise, you cannot get thin enough zones in the next step of the accretion.
I have done some rezoning.
Uh-huh. Sorry for the too technical question.
Pretty technical.
It's pretty technical. I saw a hand in the back there, so let me just...
Looks like Justin's getting it. He's getting it. Yeah, he's getting it.
So in the cartoon, the hydrogen was distributed all over the surface of the white dwarf. Is that really the way it happens, and does it matter?
We haven't done anything but 1D simulations, so I don't think I want to answer a specific question like that. People have looked at how mass gets distributed on the surface of the white dwarf. There's Mike Schar did that years ago, local thermonuclear runaways. I think Marina could say something more about that. But we only assume spherical. We are planning to go to multi-D hydro and check that, at least to see how it might affect the runaways, probably not the accretion. That's a different problem.
You mentioned that you're getting RP process kind of conditions. Could you explain that a little bit in detail, where exactly that occurs?
The highest mass accretion rates, we have densities exceeding 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 5th grams per cubic centimeter. We have temperatures exceeding 500 million degrees for times of...
And you still have hydrogen left there?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I just had two questions for you, sort of from an observation perspective. Can you say, is there a way you would observationally distinguish between the canonical steady burning and your surface burning?
Ouch. Observations. Yes.
And in particular, which one...
I'd have to think about that.
Okay. Of course, I'm particularly interested in symbiotic stars, where we see the luminosity is high enough that there must be some sort of burning going on. I was curious if you have an opinion which type that might be.
I think it depends. You have to, if you look at systems like Cal 83, it's hot. The temperatures that we see, the luminosities that we see, are what we would predict. I mean, that was the point of our modeling, was that we turned out to predict those surface conditions. Those are certainly hotter than Paula, is finding for her systems. You don't see any of the systems that Paula's been studying at temperatures of, say, 500,000 or 600,000 degrees.
I was thinking more of the typical symbiotic, which has, say, 1,000 L sun.
Those are low white dwarf masses, right? Pretty much.
It's not known well, but...
If you talk to Joanna, she says they're like 0.5, 0.6, maybe 0.4 solar masses for the white dwarf. Those are going to take forever to, of course, get to the Chandrasekhar limit.
I was just curious about the burning, the physics of the burning.
Haven't studied low mass, very low mass white dwarfs.
But they
can do it. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, actually, my question was just exactly this, about trying to understand whether or not the rate of observed supernovae can be matched by any of these single degenerate models. The most important part of it is getting the white dwarf into the region that you've been studying. So, the question I have for you is, what would be different if you did specifically, say, start at 0.7 solar masses or 0.8 solar masses, and you had something where the rate of accretion was in the range someplace between 10 to the minus 8 and or above solar masses per year, what would happen with your simulations? Would you be able to grow these white dwarfs, or would they not grow?
Haven't done it. I mean, that's the basic answer, is that we've gone as low as 1.25 solar masses and no lower. We're trying to get some support and try it at 1 or 0.8 or 0.6, but that's certainly a valid point. We need to go to lower mass white dwarfs and see whether we get the same kind of phenomena from my code. Now, Ed Sion and I, years ago, when the supersoft sources were first discovered, took his hydrostatic code and accreted for short times and got them into the supersoft regime as far as temperature and luminosity. but I haven't tried it recently, certainly with not all the big network and everything.
Yeah, I didn't have a question, but I just wanted to make a comment to the uneven covering of the hydrogen. And I just want to point out that Lars Bilson and I have a study from a few years back where we consider hydrodynamic viscosity mechanisms, and pretty generally you expect the material to spread orders of magnitude before you get to high enough depths that you worry about things like burning of the fuel. So.
Do I understand you are finding a regime where you're getting not only stable hydrogen burning, but stable helium burning behind the hydrogen shell in the accretion flow? Is that right?
Yes.
Is there a simple explanation for this question in single stars, in asymptotic giant branch stars where the two shells are advancing in tandem, one invariably finds that the helium shell pulses. And what I want to know is, what's different here?
Have you been talking to Turin? Can someone please explain to me why you make red giants in the first place?
No, but this has been known for...
The point is that I'm giving you the results of our code for a specific set of conditions. I haven't tried asymptotic giant branch stars,
but
I'm sure that I would get hydrogen and helium flashes. If I didn't, then there'd be something wrong with the code, which is not. We have used it for planetary nebula ejection, and we get things that look reasonable.
No, but I would naively have thought an AGB star was accreting onto the core as rapidly as it possibly could.
Yeah.
And it's still not a stable helium shell.
I don't think the internal structure of my systems is like that of an AGB star. For example, the underlying white dwarf is cold. It starts out cold. That's how I make them. Right now I couldn't give you that answer.
That brought up an interesting point. When you say it starts out cold, you know, if you actually had a carbon-oxygen white dwarf that had gotten to that point, there would have been some prior epoch of evolution in which it managed to, you know, be accreting and burning either explosively or not material. So what would have happened if through that prior epoch the initial conditions are different? How would that have influenced your results, do you think?
Well,
I know you may not have done it, but
what
relies on your initial conditions?
Assume that this star has gone through repeated nova outbursts, and at some point something, you know, Maxwell's demon comes in and flips a switch, and the accretion starts before the white dwarf is cooled. So yes, the internal structure should have reached some kind of equilibrium, and Dean's certainly been studying this, but it's not that structure you would get for an asymptotic giant branch star. For one of the systems that we've been following, and Maureen and I can argue about this off-site, is V723 CAS, NOVA-CAS 1995. We have been following it with SWIFT. It's still an outburst, or it's still hot. And that's 11 years. Now, what point does one of these things... And it's a long period system, by the way. A long orbital period, excuse me. So maybe we've watched one evolve from nova outbursts into a supersoft source. It's interesting in the optical, too.
I think because of time, we should close the discussion, but I'm sure that some people would like to discuss some technical questions. Thank you very much.